please the court and counsel, my name is Brian Woodward. I represent the defendant appellant Robert Soy. As your honors know, this case is here on consolidated appeals, one from the trial court's denial of the Section 2255 petition as to count one of the indictment concerning the constitutionality under the Commerce Clause and U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Russell and Jones. Second issue being the direct appeal from the trial court's sentencing order after it vacated count two of the indictment. Now, I will try to devote my time equally to both. However, I will address the constitutional issue first. As I stated, and the argument begins with the United States Supreme Court decisions in Jones and Russell. I think at this point that there would be severe double jeopardy concerns to allow the government a second bite at the apple, so to speak, by permitting it to bring in additional evidence to link up the interstate commerce nexus in order to buttress its conviction under... I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor. There were sufficient cases, I think, even out of this court, out of the Seventh Circuit, addressing those very issues, beginning with Stilwell, which was a private residence case. No, but I think the law was developed enough that had the court or had the government so chosen, and obviously they were along those lines, they just chose not to present the evidence. I don't think the defendant can be held accountable because the government failed upon their burden of proof to show an interstate nexus. There are all sorts of things they could have shown, and Your Honor touched upon it briefly when he said you could infer maybe they were multi-unit apartment buildings. We could infer maybe that these were paying tenants. We could infer that this was a restaurant that served interstate out goods that were transported interstate. Perhaps... We simply don't know that. We don't... It could have been. We could suspect not, but... you know, it's the government's burden of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't think the jury's permitted merely to infer that perhaps the commerce nexus was met. And if you look at all these cases, starting with Stilwell, Menzer, Martin, Hicks, they all... Why do I feel that's necessary? I could. Here's the problem with the conspiracy count under Section 371. There are several overt acts alleged incorporating the substantive counts. Under this court's decision in Townsend, and it's cited in the brief, and Stromberg, and Griffin Yates, in those cases, in the event that some overt act is constitutionally infirm, that is, it suffers from a legal insufficiency, then the whole count is bad. And that's why these cases and their interpretation of what is required under the Commerce Clause and the government's failure to prove that. No, they don't. But in the event. Well, the problem is, under this court's decision in Townsend, that in the event that one of those overt acts are constitutionally infirm, and to the extent... Well, it's not... No. No, but in this case it was. In this case it was. And as you read those cases, they say that if you do that... When you look at it from that standpoint, we're talking about, and the cases differentiate, as regards to a conspiracy, the difference between what's factually sufficient and what's legally sufficient. This isn't a case of factual sufficiency. If it were only a case of factual sufficiency, then Soy would lose, because obviously there are overt acts. It could be one overt act. And in this case, the jury was only required to find one overt act. But the problem... And I think that's correct, that the biggest problem is, in light of Blakely and Booker, how do we get to relevant conduct as a cross-reference from 2K1.4, the sentencing guidelines? Not at all. They may speak to this matter. If we, well, it's pretty clear that neither one of those cases invalidate the federal sentencing guidelines. There are alternatives. The guidelines are only prohibited or invalidated in the event that the Sixth Amendment is implicated. Now, yes, we do have some judicial findings. Cases that pertain to relevant conduct, that is, the death that occurred pursuant to the vacated count, which is a problem in and of itself. However, and we have a finding. I wonder if that deposit of law still holds water in light of the fact that the jury has acquitted an individual of something. That means the government's failed on their burden of proof. No, but it is the manner in which the death occurred, I believe, which is a contested fact. And it was. And it was, Your Honor, and I just pointed out in our brief. We briefed before Blakely came down. We briefed before Booker came down, so couldn't flush that out entirely. Which he already has, and he's determined it to be reckless. So it's inconceivable to Soy how he gets from reckless conduct, where under the guidelines 2A1.4, they have, you know, it's level 10 for negligent death, level 14 for a reckless death. But instead, the judge cross-referenced to 2A1.2, which is a level 33, which is an intentional murder. It's inconceivable how he got there. Now, he got there under the guise. Well, he's going to waive his rights under Booker. I'm not sure I'm willing to go that far. Obviously, we're stuck with the proposition that in the event that the guidelines are invalidated or void in their entirety, that leaves us pretty conceivably we could. There's no doubt that because of the multiple counts and 10-year maximum terms on each of those counts, that those were run consecutively under a pre-1984 scenario. Conceivably, he could be at, I think it's 720 months or something like that. Obviously, that's not the situation we want to be in. Well, no. I mean, after this is the third time I believe we're up on appeal in this case, over the past 12 years, and finally we have it down to 528 months of incarceration, which is roughly 44 years. Obviously, if we were to cross-reference 2A1.4 at a level 10 or 14, he served his time. Yeah, he served his time even under criminal. I think he's in criminal history category 3, perhaps. He's been incarcerated since 1992. That's 12 years, and I. At those levels, even setting aside for the moment the obstruction of justice, which is exactly what they addressed in the other cases, and some of the other enhancements, I mean, he still served his time in its entirety. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Andrew Baker, Assistant United States Attorney on behalf of the government. Address first the issue of the commercial buildings. In Russell, the Supreme Court adopted a per se rule that rental property affects interstate commerce. Well, I'll get to that in a minute if I could put you off and go to the full argument first about why we don't need more evidence, and the evidence is sufficient with particularly two and certainly three. Joyner recognized that and said that Russell reasoning applies to a restaurant. Ito's and Joyner held that the government wasn't even required to show that a restaurant obtained any supplies in interstate commerce. As this court said in Martin, it remains true after Jones that buildings actively used for commercial purpose, including restaurants, home offices, and so forth, that they meet commerce. So it was Ito's, there was unquestionably the Ann Cowett's private residence in count two that resulted in a reversal that's got us here on the resentencing from the 2255. That house was her private residence. There's no indication of any active employment of that resident in interstate commerce. We alleged there was claimed there was an alternative theory that we've set forth in our brief that the bombings also targeted NIPSCO meters, and that actually was part of the diversion. The meters caused the fires. Yes, that's where they put the bombs. They went to... That was part of the plan. The meters were actually placed on or under bombs to get the fires. The bombs were placed on or under meters, commercial, big meters, to get the fires, to bring the emergency personnel and police to get their diversion for their robbery. And as we quote in a brief from the testimony of one of the government witnesses who was on the inside of this, why they did that. They went to the meters, the commercial meters, to get the bigger response. The indictment charged that the bombings were affecting personal and real property at the at these addresses, affecting interstate commerce. I believe that's broad enough to include not only the real estate there of the restaurant, but also the meters. Well, they don't belong to the. They don't belong to the residents. They're the gas companies. I'm not sure, but if they're real estate, then they were covered in the real estate that's the target of the bomb, the real property that is actively employed in interstate commerce. So regardless of which property they fall in, they're commercially active property that was the target of the bombs. I don't believe it does where the target is those fixtures, those pieces of property that are employed in interstate commerce. They're part of the distribution scheme of a public utility. And I think that's the same as hitting their pumping station or a storage tower anywhere along their line. Is that in the case of actually targeting and going after those meters, if that's the property, that's sufficient. I think that has been answered and upheld twice already by this court. The issue is who the fact finder is now after Blakely and Booker. But pre-Blakely and Booker, the conduct remains the same that they're guilty, that Soy and Provod are guilty of, whether two exist as a real count or not.
I believe.
The fact findings were the subject of the two prior appeals in this case and were upheld by this court, and I believe in an hour the law, the case on that issue. It's the I can't really adequately explain that without looking at that. Well, there's I think Booker impacts who makes the decision. If Booker stands as it is now, and this court were to hold the guidelines weren't severable, so that yes, then and we believe that that's an issue that the Supreme Court's taken, and that will resolve who should make the finding. There are issues in the case that we believe we've covered that are threshold issues. The issue of whether or not you can unbundle the sentences. That's correct. If everything is sustained, then we come to the propriety. Who should have made the finding of the application of the cross-reference and how that has to be played out, and whether the guidelines are advisory or separate, or whether you're limited to that, whether we get a sentencing jury as a go-around after that. But that was litigated twice. The criminal intent and everything was addressed in the initial. The propriety of that application and reaching the first degree murder was addressed in the first direct appeal. Was saying that the findings are the same and are valid for the same reasons. And I regret that I didn't anticipate readdressing that, because I thought that had been solved by the two prior decisions. The second remand had the court address on remand from the first decision. The court addressed the issue of intent made in a finding, and that whole thing went back up on appeal again, and attacking is essentially the application of the cross reference and the point reached for the homicide, and for the reasons in those decisions, we believe that was correct, and nothing has changed. It should be the sufficiency of those findings that the court made should be sufficient under the law of the case. That's it, Your Honors. I want to thank you very much for allowing me to appear over the years before this court. I am retiring as of October 1st as an assistant United States attorney after 32 years, and I appreciate the courtesies of this court. Thank you.
feel honored to have had Attorney Baker as opposing counsel before his retirement. Purvet 2, second Purvet case, footnote 2, addressed the recklessness and how the parties got there. I don't think that's an issue any longer. I agree. There's been a finding of recklessness. No one's taking issue with that. The way Judge Lozano got there was analogizing to the arson statute, I think section 1111, perhaps 18 U.S.C. And there's a leap in logic there that I just can't quite follow. That if everyone agrees there was reckless conduct, then we're at guideline 2A1.4, and that's where we stay, level 10 or 14. Take your pick. Thank you.